Hey everyone, it's Dave. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to let everybody know that not only do I give my books away for free, but I pay for shipping. I'll sign it, send it to you. Just go to shipmeyourbook.com. Shipmeyourbook.com. Enjoy my book. Thanks so much. On this episode of The Playbook, I have the incredible CEO and co-founder of Canva, Cliff Obrecht, and we're going to talk about how to utilize the freemium model in order to build a multi-billion dollar company, how to create value in simple design. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook. This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host, David Meltzer. I am so excited from all the way on the other side of the world, Cliff Obrecht. He's the COO and co-founder of Canva. And if you are not familiar with Canva, you're about to be, because we're going to give the playbook to success. Cliff, welcome to the playbook.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, you guys have created, you know, quite a stir in a really big space, which is graphic design. You've created a platform for visual content. So your timing is impeccable. You know, how much is that is planning and how much is luck?
I think it's definitely a bit of both. Any entrepreneur that says it's all sort of planning and strategy is probably full of shit to some degree. Yeah. Can I swear on this podcast? I'm not sure.
Yeah, you got it. You're fine.
But we realized the need, and often I think any good company or idea is based on identifying a good problem. And my business partner and CEO and now wife, Melanie Perkins, was teaching design at university, and she realized the traditional tools, being like the Adobe suite, were incredibly difficult to learn. And in a world that was quickly moving to the web, in a world of Facebook and Instagram, we realized the future would be very different. And in the future, design would be collaborative, it would be online, and it would be really, really easy. And that kind of was the little nugget of wisdom in identifying that problem that sort of led us on this now 10-year plus journey to that has ended up in Canva.
It's an incredible business and it's grown exponentially. You know, I try to teach people the concept of segmentation, which is the blend of persistence with patience and understanding how things exponentially grow. At what point did you realize how big this could become? Because, you know, you don't just turn over a $6 billion business in a month. Unless you get really, that would be luck. But there is a lot of lessons that are learned in order to exponentially grow like you guys have. You know, where in the journey of the 10 years did it become apparent that, you know what, this is going to work out. We better stick to this because, you know, I know for the first few years, nobody thinks that. Where along your 10-year journey was it like, holy moly, this is getting big?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So I think Mel and I have different views on this. Mel had the big vision of what Canva could be from the start, and she always saw it as democratizing design. We're going to be the future of the publishing industry.
So she's smarter. She's smarter than you. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, she's definitely smarter than me. She's the brains of the operation. But my sort of ambitions are a little bit more incremental, and I find it hard to go from nothing, two people sitting in the living room, to thinking and sort of really capitalizing where we are now, like a 1,400 person company, 50 million monthly active users, et cetera, et cetera. So I break it down into smaller chunks, like, okay, we're two people here. What's it going to take for us to launch our very first product? And then what's it going to take for us to get our very first customer? What's it going to take for us to get our first 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 customers? And so I like to break down very large sort of ambitions into smaller chunks. I find them much more sort of easy to attain. But Mel just goes full hog for the end goal. So we approach those things very differently.
One of the other things that I find interesting, my first job out of law school was, believe it or not, probably the first freemium model ever created in 1992. I worked for a company called Westlaw. We were purchased in 95 for $3.4 billion in 1995. So as you know, that was a lot of money back then. But what we would do...
$100 billion now.
Yeah. If we bought Bitcoin with $3.4 billion in 92, we'd be really doing well. But more importantly, what was interesting is they believed in value. And I've utilized this strategy my entire career, including for my personal brand, which you're proof of my personal brand giving value to people where they gain interest in doing more with you. Well, in this freemium model that we had in 1992, we would give legal research to all the law students for free. And then when they graduated, they were addicted to what we did because it was so good. And I'm always trying to learn what the greatest aspects of a freemium model, because I think people misinterpret free for no value. And they sometimes, you know, think that just because they give it away for free, everyone's going to want it. And then they ruin their brand, I think, and their business model, because, you know, if you give somebody food that tastes terrible for free, they're not going to want to eat it anymore. And there has to be some sort of nuance in the freemium approach. Why do you think your approach works so well?
I think it worked well because we have a ruthless focus on delivering value. And we've been huge believers in our free product is our marketing channel. And if you view it as your marketing channel, so you invest a lot into your free product and you don't put all these disgusting barriers where people are always asked to pay or the product's so limited they actually can't get a job to be done, that's not going to propel your company. So we believed in adding as much value into our free product as possible. But that also goes to our pro product. If you've got a very, very valuable free product, your pro product needs to be a step change bigger and better than your free product. And for Canva, you have access to hundreds of millions of images, templates. You have access to our whole content library. You can resize your designs. You have all these extra features. And so we are really at the point where we don't really care if users don't upgrade in their first few sessions. We want our users, our customers, to come to Canva, love the product, get so addicted, get so much value out of that product, realize they're using Canva to grow their business, and then be more than happy to pay for those additional features, those additional bits of content. And we get a lot of feedback about how valuable that is. And the same thing with our pro product. It's $12.95 a month. You get a disproportionate amount of value. Like you get, like I said, 50 million images. You get a video content library, templates. It's crazy the amount of value you get. So that's the sort of business you want to build, and that also maps to sort of word of mouth and also retention of your customers as well.
Well, and we hear it all the way over here. So I know you're doing a great job with it and providing the value and the service and not only managing expectations, but exceeding it. But you not only treat your customers correctly. One of the things that I've noted in doing my research is you treat your employees extremely well. You're the number one place to work in Australia. And that to me always signifies success. You know, where did that strategy come from to treat and put your employees first, even before yourselves and your consumers? You know, where did that strategy and how has it paid off even through COVID?
Yeah. So, I mean, it came from the very earliest of days where we wanted to create a company that we wanted to work at every day, where come from a small town in Australia. We're pretty humble people. Not our parents are working class. And we just didn't want to work with dickheads. It's sort of colloquial term we use in Australia. And we just wanted to work with people that were good at what they do, who were humble about it. They enjoyed coming to work. We could have some good banter. And that's kind of pervade. And in the very earliest days when we were five people, obviously we're working out of home. I'd go into the kitchen and I'd make sandwiches for everyone. And I wasn't just going to make sandwiches for myself. And that sort of like seeded the food for everyone thing. And as that scaled and scaled and scaled, it did hit one point where I was like, I'm actually now trying to feed 20 people. This has taken like an hour and a half out of my day. I probably need to hire someone in and give away my Lego and take away the cooking duty. And that happened at about 20 people. And then as we've sort of progressed, it's really come back to our values, and we've got really core values. Like one of them is be a good human, which really speaks to the type of people we want to hire. And we use that sort of values-based methodology in our hiring, in our performance. And so it's not just like, are you doing a good job? Are you being a good human? Are you living our values? And are you someone like everyone enjoys working with? Because you spend one third of your living life generally at work, through your working years. You want that to be a fun period.
Yeah, even with COVID and remote working, which obviously has hit Australia as well. One of the philosophies that you have, though, you have an interesting balance that a lot of companies don't adhere to. I do, is combining attitude and experience. Which one holds more weight and which one has been a better asset during remote working periods, the attitude or the experience?
They're both important. However, I would much, I mean, we just don't accept people with bad attitudes. They become cancers within the organization. If you have someone with, everyone has a bad day. That's not to say you can't bring your whole self to work and have a bad day or this or that. It's just that, I mean, at an organization of 1,400 people, we've inevitably made bad hires. And the bad hires come in with a sense of distrust in the organization. And that may come from some deep-seated issues or previous experiences. But like people that come in and just, there's some people that come in and just want to pick holes in everything you do. And as a founder, we're always doing our best and things are continuously breaking all the time. And you want people that are going to help you on that journey. They're going to identify problems because there's always problems at a rapidly growing startup. But they're going to say, hey, here's this problem and this is how I think we should fix it. And they'll go about helping you in that journey of growing the business, fixing the issues. And then you get this people that come around and say like, oh, look at that problem. They're doing that because they don't value us, or they're doing this because they've got like bad intentions. And really, like, if you get a few of those people together, and those people always gravitate together and have these little sessions where they're just negative, that creates a bad culture. And if you don't stamp on that straight away, and the way we generally address that is that we ask it, oh, hey, like, we have this thing called the fix it form, and you can report anything in the company that you think is broken. It's totally anonymous, or you can add your name. And that comes directly to Mel and I, the three founders of the company. And we read every single one of them and pretty much get on any problem straight away. And there's constantly problems swelling up. So we like solution-focused people, not people that are just problem-focused.
You know, it's interesting because you have the three co-founders, one being your wife. And, you know, I read that you guys kind of fit together perfectly in your personalities. I always tell my wife, I said, you know, I may not be perfect, but I'm perfect for you. It seems like you and your two co-founders.
I'm going to use that.
but I think you and your two co-founders are perfect for each other. One of the things I always admire, and I adore my wife, but, you know, I can't imagine growing a multi-billion-dollar business with my wife. I so look forward to the after the activity I get paid for conversations, to have like such an overwhelming success that just encompasses my entire relationship. How have you segregated or, you know, utilized your, you know, obviously wonderful marriage, but talk about something besides business when things are just, you know, so overwhelmingly big and successful. Do you ever have time just to talk about normal married life?
Yeah, we've had to build that muscle. I mean, it does. You can get in this sort of habit of just talking about work stuff all the time. But I think to do your best work, and this is something we've definitely learned over time and getting better at, but still definitely not perfect at, in order to do your best work when you're at work, you need sort of mental relaxation time. Your brain is a muscle. And if you're constantly flexing that muscle is going to become fatigued. And I'm starting to think about work and building a business more and more in a playful sense. I mean, it's just like playing a game. I mean, I'm an incredibly competitive person. Like, you get me on the Monopoly board and I'm out for death, man. I'm trying to kill everyone. I'm getting all those hotels. And same on the sporting field. Not that I'm a great sportsman, but like, if I'm playing a game, I'm playing to win. And like, I really am starting to treat work and building a business a lot more like a game, where when I'm strapped in, I'm giving it absolutely everything, bringing my whole self to work, giving it my all. But also, like, when I'm off work, like when we've I finally shut the laptop for the day, or we're going on a walk in the park, or we're going out in nature or whatever, I try and really flip the switch. And for the last 10 years, I've done a really, really terrible job of this. So maybe I'm just trying to coach myself here as much as anything, and I'm not perfect. But having those breaks actually allows you to relax and your mind to have space. And it's from that sort of mental relaxation that good ideas actually come. If you're flat out all day, and one of the sort of tangible things I've done is I very often delete my email and Slack from my phone. I've already deleted Instagram, Facebook, and all the social scrolling apps, even YouTube. It's just taking up too much of my mind space. And I'm trying to really create that differentiator between sort of like work and when I'm on, and I'm like on the digital things, responding to everyone, lots of threads open, to sort of when I'm off. And I think having that sort of switch has been beneficial in actually being more productive.
And speaking of productivity too, you know, there's a paradigm shift that I see in your marketing. And that's one of, you know, design has always been seen as a expense, right? This is something that we have to figure out, and it doesn't or isn't capable of articulating a value greater than what you're asking for. But it seems like with the huge amount of value that you provide, you're able to shift that paradigm from expense. What is one of your philosophies, strategies, or perspective on expense versus investment, and how do you articulate so well in your marketing stuff the value to be higher than that which you're paying for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it comes back to sort of our mission and the tailwinds that are supporting that mission in regards to the web and the world are becoming increasingly visual places. And the need for businesses to communicate visually is no longer a nice to have thing. It's a table stake. So in order to communicate your ideas externally to customers, to investors, to whoever, being able to communicate visually is like a critical skill. And that maps to sort of like what all students are currently learning, or all knowledge workers. If you're a knowledge worker and you don't have the ability to construct a good presentation, or if you're in marketing and you can't actually compose that good video or that good social media graphic that will have the right impact, then you're really not equipping yourself in today's visual day and age. And so how that maps to our marketing and how we've evolved that, it really comes back to what you mentioned around sort of giving the most amount of value possible and sort of helping people get into the product as quickly as possible, showing them the value and then showing them so much value that they immediately upgrade and then pay us, which then pays more ads.
Last question. Obviously, you've had extraordinary success over the past decade. So I'd love to see your mindset on what is next for your dynamic trio, and what's going to get you there?
We have a very simple two-step plan. The first is build one of the most valuable companies in the world. The second is do the most good we can do. So I mean, Mel and I, who's my wife, we have a long journey ahead of us with Canva, where we're really moving into organizations. We've launched full collaboration. And so we're really becoming the collaborative visual communication platform. And that's really our mission over the next few years, backed by a lot of AI and really cool stuff that allows people to create content collaboratively really quickly and have that content really impact their business in a positive way. But sort of personally, where we're going, I'm really excited where we don't need money. Like, who needs like tons and tons of money? So we're allocating all our sort of money to make the world a better place. And as a company as well, we're trying to do the most good we can do and figure out what the platform we've created, how we can leverage that in order to empower others. So we're setting up a design hub in Africa, where we've got a bunch of these social initiatives where we're wanting to give work, we're wanting to educate people, and we're wanting to really sort of do whatever we can. And we're very early in this journey, but like give back to the world, because we think that's our obligation. Now we have a platform and a company at the current scale we're at.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love to find entrepreneurs like yourself and your wife that believe in the concept and mission of making a lot of money so you can help a lot of people and still have a lot of fun. And I can't wait for things to open up, because I want to come down to Australia, because you guys seem like a ton of fun. And I appreciate everything you do to empower others to be happy around the world and create such great change to create a better world for all of us to live in. And I'm glad also to hear that tomorrow is going to be an amazing day for all of us. Thank you for giving us a glimpse of a future there in Australia, but also the future of Canva. Cliff Obrecht, COO and co-founder of Canva, thank you so much. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.